10 minutes after he'd finished up the meeting, Hank was outside in the barn, leaning his cheek against the warm, drum-tight and pulsing stomach of the Jersey milk cow, grinning to himself over the way he had consented to do the milking while Viv helped clear up the kitchen.
"Just this once, woman," he had let her know. "Just this once, so don't go getting any notions."
She'd smiled and looked away. He knew she hadn't been fooled by his hard-ass tone any more than Joe had been fooled by his whistling upstairs. Viv knew what old Henry said about appearances. He wondered if she also knew how much he enjoyed coming out and doing the milking. He moved his ear to the animal's sleek bulk and could hear her guts working. He liked the sound. He liked the cow. He liked feeling her warmth and squeezing the rhythm of milk into the pail. It was a dumbass thing keeping a milk cow these days when you could buy milk cheaper in alfalfa, but damn it, a cow's tit was a nice change from an axe handle. And the soft working of a cow's gut was a relief after the old man snorting and farting and John's bullshitting and Orland's wife screeching. Well, they didn't really mean anything by it. The milk rang into the pail, then muffled its ringing in folds of white froth, a measured bell sounding through thick, creamy warmth. This is Hank's bell. On the river, the motorboat gnashed at the leaf-dappled water as Joe Ben ferried the loads of people across. Cars started, spinning gravel to get back onto the highway. Henry's plaster cast thundered and rolled on the docks. Dumbass thing keeping a cow. In the deepening sky where the spear-point firs scratched the clouds, already a moon, like a cast-off pairing from the setting sun. This is Hank's bell, too. But God almighty, ain't they warm to lean against. On the docks, the noisy woodpecker of a man parades up and down, shaking his plume of hair that is yellow and coarse as a bundle of broken toothpicks when seen close up. 50 yards away, it's white as a thunderhead. 50 yards away at the wrong end of a telescope, the drink-whipped cheeks of John glow with ruddy health, and Orland's wife steps into the waiting boat with a foot as demure and dainty as that of a thoroughbred colt. Joe Ben's poor hacked gridiron of a face shines out across the green water as pure as a cameo, and his potato-shaped wife as a swan in polka-dotted taffeta, 50 yards away. This is Hank's bell, secret between peaks of foam, muffled in warm white valleys. This is Hank's bell ringing. In her cluttered kitchen, amid an architectural marvel of dirty dishes, Viv wipes with her wrist that lock of hair that always touches her brow when she hurries, and hums, "Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming." The dogs bulge the back screen as they watch the venison bones and bread scraps and gravy leavings pile up in the chipped porcelain pan. Past the barn, up in the orchard, the little iron trees with the dusty gray-green leaves beginning to curl at the edges hang out their tributes to the sun, brass apples, and the summer sun sliding away into the ocean, old and mellow, takes the offering graciously. The gulls rock above a red surf, the long strung-out flocks of black long necks that like to play that they're part of the sea and fly always a foot above the water, matching every swell, every trough, make one last black thrust before finally settling to roost on the water like a speckled blanket against the night. When it rings, it's like ripples in a pool, spreading in all directions. In town, Grissom reads the comic books from his book racks, his eyes glittering with Batman and Robin and Paregoric. Boney Stokes comes from his house and moves along the sidewalk like a comical black stork, step-hop-stepping the distance to his store to check his son's bookkeeping and counting the steps to make sure no one has stolen a piece of the sidewalk. Coach Llewellyn blows his whistle and sends the team into one last clattering, sweating, dull run-through of a play they've already practiced a dozen times. Hank sets himself for the blow of the defensive end's knee, fakes a quick sidestep, cuts back neatly, catching the boy's charge on his thigh pad. The end goes down with a tired grunt, and they roll together in the crushed smells of grass and sand as the halfback gallops past through the opening. The coach blows his whistle to call an end to practice, the sound stringing out on the dusk like a piece of tinsel. "Hey, Hank!" Be nice if it could ring like this all the time. "Hank!" But it's hard to stop out other noises. "In here, Joe, the milk house."
"Hankus?"
Joe Ben poked his face through the milk house window, spitting away a sunflower seed. "I done that postal card to Leland. You want to come in and put something on it from you personal?"
"I'll be in just a shake. I'm just stripping out the last of her."
Joe's head withdrew. Hank put the milking stool back on top of the big box that housed the emergency generator and carried the pail of milk to the side door. He put his shoulder against the door and slid it wide, then returned to unlatch the stanchion from the cow's drowsing head and hurry her back into the pasture with a slap on the flank. By the time he'd walked back to the house with the pail of milk knocking against his leg, Viv had finished the dishes, and Jan was upstairs getting her kids ready for bed. Joe was bent intently over the postcard on the breakfast table, rereading it. Hank put the pail down on the drain board and wiped his hands on his thighs.
"Let me have a look at it. I suppose I should add something."
And the postman, sneezing blood over a table full of third class, advises his superior, "I don't think it was any accident. I think it was too perfect to be coincidental. I think that boy out there is a dangerous psycho, and I think the blast was planned." And the pinball machine flashes, and the clouds file past. The bus huffs and hisses its blunt nose out into the traffic finally, where it swings hugely, ceremoniously west through the bright picture postcard countryside. The hand appears. The postcard flutters, dips, explodes, splintering wood and window. The lawn bucks and glitters. Evenright spreads his rear end on another gas station toilet seat and opens another package of Tums. Jonathan Drager leaves a meeting in Red Bluff before it's half over, with the excuse that he has to drive on north to Eugene, but goes instead to a cafe where he sits and writes in his notebook. Man is certain of nothing but his ability to fail. It is the deepest faith we have, and the unbeliever, the blasphemer, the dissenter, will stimulate in us the most righteous of furies. A schoolboy hates the cocky-acting kid who says he can walk the fence and never fall. A woman despises the girl who was confident that her beauty will get her man. A worker is never so angered as by an owner who believes in the predominance of management, and this anger can be tapped and used. And inside the bus, reclined in his seat near the window, Lee dozed and woke and dozed again, seldom opening more than one eye at a time to watch America flash past behind his tinted glasses. Slow. Stop. Resume speed. Step up to quality. With elegant young sociables entertaining each other at a cookout, it's what's up front, with the same young sociables elegantly relaxing indoors after the ordeal outside. Caution. Slow. Stop. Resume speed. Lee dozed and woke, moving west over the bus's big strumming engine. Evenright leapfrogs down the southbound 99 from restroom to restroom, dozing and waking indifferently, and watching the road signs explode past. Drager cruises up from Red Bluff, stopping frequently for coffee and writing in his book, and was rather glad that he hadn't bought that paperback novel. Jenny watches the clouds marshaling out to sea and begins a low sing-song, deep-down chant. "Oh, clouds, oh, rain." From New Haven to Newark, to Pittsburgh, where there's life, with lots of even teeth, lots of spaghetti and garlic bread, there's Bud, and beer cans turned, labeled a camera. "Dying of the drizzling shits, goddamn it all." Evenright chalked another markup against his nemesis as he swung to stop at another station. Cleveland and Chicago. Get your kicks on Route 66. Cafe owners are more frustrated than the common laborer, Drager writes. The common laborer answers only to the foreman. The cafe owner answers to every patron who stops in. St. Louis, Columbia, Kansas City, for a man-sized way to stop perspiration odor, men in speed stick with the scent that's all man. Who does that hard-nose think he is, damn it, acting like God Almighty? Denver, Cheyenne, Laramie, Rock Springs, the soft coal capital of the world. The hardest man, Drager writes, is but a shell. Pocatello, Boise. Welcome to Oregon. Speed limit strictly enforced. Just wait till I shove this report under that damned hard nose. Burns Bend, 88 miles to Eugene, Oregon's second market. Man, Drager writes, is, does, will, can't. Sisters, rainbow, blue river, oh clouds, Jenny chants, oh rain, come against the man, I say. Finn Rock, Vita, Leeburg, Springfield, and only in Eugene seemed to come awake. He had made this trip without quite realizing it. During stops, he'd bought candy bars and Coke and gone to the bathroom, then returned to his seat, though there might have been 20 minutes left before departure. But as he neared Eugene, the scenery began to brush long-shut doors and rattle rusty locks, and as the bus, a different bus, rickety and uncomfortable, began the climb from Eugene into the long range of mountains that separates the coast from the Willamette Valley and the rest of the continent, he found himself becoming more alert and excited. He watched the green stand of mountains build before him, the densening of ditch growth, the clear, silver-shrouded clouds moored to the earth by straight and thin strands of autumn smoke, like dirigibles. And those great, growling, gear-grinding log trucks charging out of the wilderness with grilled grins. They were like Grendel's Dam. I would probably throw in at this time, or rather then, at that time, to keep the alliterative rolling, but as a child they were like terrible dragons that nightly came bawling down out of the bewitched mountains to make a shambles of my little boy dreams. Airships of silver mist, GMC fiends, these resurrections, and by no means the last of the fancies of flight and fiend that would follow that postcard from Oregon. Airships of silver mist, GMC fiends, these resurrected childhood similes, these fancies of flight and ferocity were the first awakening sights in my days of riding, and the first indication that I had perhaps made a hasty choice. I could still turn around and go back, I reminded myself. I could do that. What's that? Asked the man sitting across the aisle from me, an unshaven sack of odors that I hadn't noticed before. What's that you say? Nothing, excuse me, I was just thinking out loud. I dream out loud. You know that? I do for a fact. Runs the old lady nuts. Keeps her awake? I asked cordially, a little embarrassed by my slip. Yeah, no, not the talking. She keeps awake all the time waiting, see, for me to dream. She's scared, see, she'll miss me saying something. I don't mean just catch me at something. She knows I'm past gallivanting, or she sure as hell should know. But just, she says, because it's like a fortune teller, the way I carry on. I dream like the Dickens, predictions and everything. To prove his point, he let his head drop back to the pillow on the seat and closed his eyes. He grinned broadly. You'll see. His lips slackened, parted, and in another minute he was snoring and muttering away. You must not buy that place from Elkins. Mark this well. Great God, I thought, looking at the yellow grillwork of this new dragon. What have you come back to? I turned away from the stubble-cheeked sight beside me to stare out the bus window at the receding geometry of the Willamette Valley farmland. Rectangle walnut groves, parallelograms of bean fields, green trapezoid pastures dotted with red cattle, the abstract splash of autumn, and tried to assure myself, "You have just come back to quaint old Oregon is all. That's all. Quaint, beautiful, blooming Oregon." But the dreamer beside me hiccuped and added,
"Place is just overrun with Canada thistle and niggerheads."
And my reassuring picture of assurance faded like the wind. Only a few miles ahead of Lee's bus on the same road, Evenright decides to stop at the Stamper House before going on into Wakanda. He wants to confront Hank with the evidence, to see the look on the bastard's face when he sees we got the goods on him. We crested the summit and started down. I caught sight of a sign on a narrow white bridge that stood like a guidepost in my memory. "Wild Man Creek," the sign instructed me, meaning the little stream we had just crossed. "Fancy that, man. Oh, Wild Man Creek. How my little imagination used to seize upon that name when I accompanied Mother on one of her frequent trips to Eugene and back." I leaned close to the window to see if any of the creatures I had fashioned still inhabited the prehistoric banks. Down a familiar stretch of highway, Wild Man Creek ran, snorting and squalling, foam whipping about the mossy teeth of rock, shaggy green hair of pine and cedar slashings, a beard matted with fern and berry vine. Through the fogging window, I watched him as he crouched, snarling in a little glade, catching his breath in a blue pool before he went leaping off again down a grade, tearing away bank and bottom in a frenzy of impatience. And I recalled that he was the first of the tributaries that would eventually merge down these slopes into Big Wakanda Aga, the shortest big river, or biggest short, pick your own, in the world. Joe Ben answered Evenright's honking and took the boat across to get him. Inside the house, they found Hank reading the Sunday funnies. Evenright shoved the report under his nose and demanded, "How does this smell, Stamper?" Hank took a long sniff, looking about.
"Smells like somebody in here dirtied his britches, Floyd."
And watching, seeing half-remembered farmhouses and landmarks stroking past, I couldn't quite shake the sensation that the road I traveled moved not so much through miles and mountains as back through time, just as the postcard had come forward. This uneasy sensation provoked a glance at my wrist, and I thereupon discovered that my days of inactivity had allowed my self-winder to unwind.
"Say, excuse me," I turned again to the sack across from me. "Could you tell me the time?"
"The time?"
This stubble split in a grin.
"Golly, fella, we don't have such a thing as the time. You from out of state, ain't that so?"
I admitted it, and he thrust hands in his pockets and laughed as though they were tickling him in there.
"Time, eh? Time? They got the time so fouled up that I guess there doesn't nobody really know it. You take me,"
he offered, leaning the whole prize toward me.
"Now you take me. I'm a mill worker, and I work switch shifts, sometimes weekends off, sometimes a day here, a night someplace else. So you'd think that'd be enough of a mess, wouldn't you? But then they got this time thing, and I sometimes work one day standard, the next day daylight. Sometimes even come to work on daylight and go home on standard. Oh, boy, time. I tell you, you name it. We got fast time, slow time, daylight time, night time, Pacific time, good time, bad time. Yeah, if we Oregonians was hawking time, we'd be able to offer some variety. Awfulest mix-up they ever had."
He laughed and shook his head, looking as though he couldn't have enjoyed the confusion more. The trouble started, he explained, when the Portland district was legislated daylight time and the rest of the state standard.
"All them dang farmers got together is why daylight got beat for the rest of the state. Danged if I see why a cow can't learn to get up at a different time just as easy as a man, do you?"
During the ride, I managed to find out that the chambers of commerce of other large cities, Salem, Eugene, had decided to follow Portland's lead because it was better for their business. But the danged mudballs in the country would have no part of such high-handed dealing with their polled wishes, and they continued to do business on standard. So some towns didn't officially change to daylight, but adopted what they called fast time, to be used only during the week. Other towns use daylight only during store hours.
Anyway, what it comes down to is nobody in the whole danged all-fired state knowing what time it is. Don't that take all?
I joined him in his laughter, then settled back to my window, pleased that the whole danged all-fired state was as ignorant of the time of day as I was. Like Brother Hank, signing his name in capitals, it fit. At the house, Hank finished glancing through the report, then asked of Evenright,
"How come such a big strike trying to get a little free time, anyhow? What are you boys going to do with a few extra hours a day if you get it?"
"Never mind that. In this day and age, a fellow needs more free time."
"Might be, but I'm damned if I'm going to foot the bill for that fella's free time."
Down through the Druid Wood, I saw Wild Man join with Cleaver Creek, put on weight, exchange his lean and hungry look for one of more well-fed fanaticism. Then came Chichimunga, the Indian influence, whooping along with its banks war-painted with lupin and columbine. Then Dog Creek, then Olson Creek, then Weed Creek. Across a glacier-raked gorge, I saw Lynx Falls, spring hissing and spitting from her lair of fire-bright vine maple, claw the air with silver talons, then crash, screeching into the tangle below. Darling Ida Creek slipped demurely from beneath a covered bridge to add her virginal presence, only to have the family name blackened immediately after by the bawdy rollicking of her brash sister, Jumping Nellie. There followed scores of relatives of various nationalities, White Man Creek, Dutchman Creek, Chinaman Creek, Dead Man Creek, and even a Lost Creek, claiming with a vehement roar that, in spite of hundreds of other creeks in Oregon bearing the same name, she was the one and only original. Then Leaper Creek, Hideout Creek, Bossman Creek. I watched them, one after another, pass beneath their bridges to join in the gorge running alongside the highway, like members of a great clan marshaling into an army, rallying, swelling, marching to battle as the war chant became deeper and richer. At the peak of the argument, old Henry came crashing in, making so much noise neither Hank nor Evenright could hear. Joe Ben took the old man aside.
"Henry, you being in here is going to make things worse. How about you waiting over in the pantry?"
"The boogerin' pantry?"
"Sure. That way you can sneak a listen without them being on to you, you see."
Stamper Creek was the last of the small tributaries to join. Family history had it that this was the creek up which my Uncle Ben had disappeared in a frenzy of drink and despair to masturbate himself to death. This creek crossed under the highway, fell into the gorge with all the others, and these waters enlisted the South Fork, which had been rallying its own band from the mountains to my left then, with a catching of breath and a racing of pulse. I saw what had a few miles back been wild streams and rivulets turn from charging green and white into the wide, composed, blue-back surface of the Wakanda Auga, moving across the green valley like liquid steel. There should have been background music. Through the crack in the pantry door, old Henry could hear Hank and Evenright speaking. The voices were angry. He could tell that much. He concentrated, trying to make out what they were saying, but his own breath was too loud. It roared about the little closet like a gale.
"Can't hear so red hot no more. Breath pretty good, though. Just listen."
He grinned at himself in the dark, smelling the apples in their boxes, the Clorox smell of rat droppings, the banana oil of the old shotgun he held.
"Yeah, and smell good, too. Keen nose still on the old dog."
He grinned, fumbling with the shotgun in the dark, wishing he could hear clear enough to know what to do. When the bus dropped on down out of the foothills and rounded a curve, and I got my first look at the house across that cold blue surface, I received something of a pleasant shock. The old house was 10 times more striking than I remembered. In fact, it didn't seem possible that I could have forgotten its looking so magnificent. They must have rebuilt it completely, I thought. But as the bus drew closer, I was forced to concede that I could discern no actual change, no repairs or renovations. If anything, it looked older. But yes, that was it. Someone had removed the cracked coat of cheap white paint from all the sides. The window sills, the shutters, and all the other trimmings had been kept up in dark green, almost blue-green, but the rest of the house had been relieved of all paint. The crazy porch with its rough-hewn posts, the broad hand-split shaking that covered roof and sides, the huge front door, all had been stripped to allow the salt wind and bleaching rain to polish the wood to a rich pewter gray shine. The bushes along the bank were trimmed, but instead of being attacked with that mathematical dedication one so often finds in suburban landscaping, they'd been trimmed for a purpose, to let in light or to afford a better view of the river and make the dock walk more accessible. The flowers that bloomed at random around the porch and along the sides of the embankment had obviously required great care and attention, but again, there was nothing forced or unnatural. They weren't flowers bred in Holland and raised in California and flown in to be pampered in local nurseries. They were the flowers common to the area, rhododendron and wild rose, trillium and ghost fern, and even some of the cursed Himalaya berry that the denizens of the coast battle the year round. I was thunderstruck because, difficult as it was for me to imagine either old Henry or brother Hank or even Joe Ben accidentally achieving the subtle, spare beauty that I saw across the river there, it was 100 times more ridiculous imagining that any of them had done it on purpose.
It used to be so simple when I could hear better. Things was easy to figure. You come up to a rock, you either jumped it or heaved it out in the path. Now, I don't know. 20 or 30 years ago, I'd have made sure there were a shell in this barrel instead of make sure there ain't. Now, I don't know. The old nigger don't hear so clear no more is one trouble.
With my last dollar, I purchased from the bus driver the privilege of alighting in front of the garage instead of having to ride 8 miles on into town and walk back. As I stood in the dust, the driver advised me that my measly buck paid for nothing more than his stopping and letting me off. He couldn't foul up his schedule by opening the baggage compartment.
"Sonny, this ain't the Wells Fargo stagecoach,"
and left me protesting in his exhaust. So, there stands our hero, with nothing but the wind in his hair, the clothes on his back, and the carbon monoxide in his nostrils. Quite a contrast, I mused, crossing the road from that boatload of essentials I left with 12 years ago. I hope the calf is well fatted. On the gravel apron near the garage, a new pea-green Bonneville gleamed in the sun. I walked past it and on into the three-sided affair that served as shelter, machine shop, dockhouse, and garage. Grease and dust upholstered the floor and walls in a rich mauve velvet. Mud hornets whizzed through dusty sunbeams near the roof. A yellow jeep, heaped with equipment, rested box-like and resigned to its load near one wall, and beyond its cracked headlights, I saw that Hank had purchased a bigger and brighter motorcycle. It was tethered on a chain against the back wall and bedecked with black leather and polished brass, like a show horse in parade trappings. I looked about the garage for a phone. I'd taken for granted that they must have installed some kind of device for signaling when a boat was desired, but I saw nothing, and when I glanced through the cobwebbed window toward the house across the river, I caught sight of something that made me forsake all hope of such modern convenience. Swung from a pole was a tattered cloth with numbers on it, the signals used for ordering wares from the Stokes grocery truck that came by every other day. the same primitive method of communication that had been going on years before my birth.
But by God, the old hound don't need good ears for some things, goddammit. You don't need good ears to know where to draw the boogin' line. And all this goddamn telling me it's best, old man, you keep out of sight and out of trouble, that don't set so good. I get tired of...
I left the garage and was wondering how my modulated tenor, tuned for polite classroom intercourse back in a civilized world, could be expected to carry across the expanse of water, when I saw a disturbance at the massive front door across the way.
By God, maybe can't hear so good, but I know what's right and what ain't, by God, if I don't.
I saw a stocky man in a brown suit come running across the lawn in thick-legged haste, holding his hat to his head with one hand and an attaché case in the other, shouting back at the house. Stirred by the shouts, a battalion of hounds charged from beneath the house, and the man cut short his tirade, paused a moment to flail at the pack with a case, which burst open in a bright yellow blizzard of paper, turned to run again, dogs and paper flapping at his heels.
By God, one thing I just ain't about to tolerate is...
The front door banged again, and another figure came charging out.
God damn it, is...
Brandishing an ugly black shotgun and making a clamor that put to shame the barking and shouting that had gone before. The man in the suit dropped his case, turned to recover it, saw the terrifying approach of this new menace, and ran on without it down the incline to the dock, leaped into the fire engine red launch at the mooring, and began wildly jerking at the motor rope. He paused once to look back up the plank walkway at the awesome creature storming through the dogs and bearing vengefully down on him, then redoubled his frantic efforts to start the motor.
"Get back, Henry Stamper! You gone crazy with age! There's laws in this country!" "Is...
Oh, Jesus, he's got a shotgun! Start! Start!" As the other man came closer and closer,
"What's wrong with this boogin' gun?
Start! Start!
I'll by the goddamn see to who unloaded. One thing I won't tolerate, by God, is...
Louder and louder.
"Start! Oh, God, here he comes! Is... Oh, God, start!"
Across the river, Henry had dropped his gun. No, now he had it again. Now he was down. Now he was moving toward the dock again. His hair flew out behind him in a long white mane. His arm pumped him onward. He was impressive in a plaid shirt and a pair of knee-length wool undershorts and a plaster cast that ran in one piece from the tip of one foot, seemingly all the way up his side and out over his shoulder, forcing him to carry that arm bent before him as though ossified there. Why, the old trooper has grown so venerably ancient, I thought, that he's preserving his matchless idiocy for posterity by gradually having himself done over in limestone.
If anybody goddamn thinks for one minute that just because I'm...
He swayed and teetered in his restricted advance and struck at the welder of hounds with a shotgun, which served alternately as firearm, crutch, and club. He reached the dock, and I could hear the thundering boom of his plaster leg as it sounded on the boards, the report reaching me a second after the foot set down, so the sound appeared to issue from the lifting foot instead of the dock. He lumbered forward down the dock like a comic Frankenstein's monster, booming that foot, striking about with the gun and cursing so fast and loud that the words were sanctified to wholesome noise.
"Because I never yet rose to see the goddamn day. I weren't up to running my own son-of-a-bitching affairs, and if any bastard thinks..."
The man in the boat jerked the motor to life and threw off the mooring just as the three other characters in this drama came running from the house and down onto the dock. Two men and what I ventured to think a woman in jeans and an orange-colored apron and a long braid flopping down the back of her ubiquitous sweatshirt. She passed the two men and scampered across the dock to try to calm old Henry's raving. The two men held back, letting him rave his damnedest and laughing so they could barely walk. Henry ignored the calming and laughing alike and continued to rail at the man in the boat, who must have concluded that the gun was empty or broken because he'd pulled a safe 20 yards away from the dock and was idling the boat at a standstill into the current so he could have his turn at shouting back at the others. All up and down the river I could see startled gulls flapping airward in a frightened flight from the uproar. Oh, Lordy, what am I doing with this here scattergun? Oh, Lordy, I don't hear so good. I truly do not. Henry appeared to be tiring. One of the men, the taller one, who I decided must be Hank, what other Caucasian ever moved with that slack-limbed indolence, left the others and loped into the boat shed and reappeared, bent in an odd position as he shielded something with his cuffed hands. He stood at the edge of the dock in this position for a moment, then straightened up to throw whatever he held in the direction of the boat. Oh, Lordy, what's happening? And then there was nothing but silence, as the whole cast, the figures on the dock, the petrified brown lump in the boat, even the pack of dogs, stood perfectly still and quiet for perhaps 2¾ seconds before a thundering blast right next to the boat jammed a white column of water 40 feet into the hot, smoky air, ka-whoomp, like an Old Faithful erupting in the middle of the river. As the water fell back into the boat, the men on the dock roared with laughter. They stumbled with their laughter. They grew weak with it. They finally collapsed under it like drunks. Even old Henry's cursing became so diluted with laughter that he was finally forced to lean weakly against a piling, no longer able to support both himself and the colossal amusement that shook him. The lump in the boat saw Hank heading back into the shed to reload and overcame his shell shock enough to gun the boat motor on full so that he was out of range of Hank's next throw by a good 3 feet. The explosion bucked the boat forward like a surfboard catching a 15-foot comber, and this set off new hysterics on the dock.
Anyhow, by God, I guess I showed him he can't tell me how to run my business. Here, good or no?
The boat pulled up to the landing, where I watched, and the man grabbed for a hold on one of the bumper tires that were dangling in the water. He leaped out onto the landing without tying the boat or turning off the motor, and I was compelled to make a courageous lunge to catch the rope at the rear of the boat, lest it escape pilotless downriver. As I stood there, with my feet braced, holding the boat while it tugged to be off again like a whale on a leash, I thanked the man pleasantly for bringing transportation across to me and congratulated him on the little welcoming home skit he had so generously taken part in. He stopped, gathering what was left of his papers, and raised a reddened round face in my direction, seeming to notice me for the first time.
"And I'll just bet you're another one of the scabbin' bastards."
He thrust his jigs-like face in my direction. Little rivulets of water running out of his frizzy red hair kept getting in his eyes, forcing him to blink and rub at the sockets with both fists like a child crying.
"Ain't I right?" he demanded, rubbing and blinking. "Huh? Ain't I now?"
But before I could summon an appropriately clever answer, he turned and lurched up the planks toward his new car, cursing so mournfully that I wasn't sure whether to laugh at the man or pity him. I lashed the impatient boat to a mooring and went back to the garage for the jacket I'd left lying on the jeep. When I returned, I saw across the way that Hank had removed his shirt and shoes and was in the process of pulling down his trousers. He and the other man, Joe Ben, from the banty-legged way he stood, were still laughing. Old Henry was working his way back up the bank toward the house, much more laboriously than he'd come down. As Hank pulled a leg from his pants, he supported himself by leaning a hand on the shoulder of the woman standing near him. This must be Brother Hank's pale Wildwood's flower, I decided, barefooty and fattened out round and comfortable on huckleberry and pemmican. Hank finished with his pants and made a flat, whacking dive into the river, the same racing dive I'd watched him practice years ago as I peeked from behind curtains of my room. As he started stroking across, I noticed that the neat, strength-conserving stroke of the racing swimmer was somehow marred. There was a hitch in the smoothness of the movement, every two or three strokes, a jog in the rhythm that seemed caused by something other than a lack of practice. If one could be permitted the term in reference to a swimmer, I suppose we might say that Hank had developed a limp. And as I watched, I thought, I was right. He is past his prime. The old giant is weakening. Perhaps that recompense of blood won't be so difficult to claim as I feared. Heartened by this thought, I got into the boat, untied the rope, and with some experimenting, managed to turn the bow about and head in Hank's direction. The boat moved only slightly faster than idling speed, but I couldn't fathom the throttle on the motor and had to proceed at the rate Jiggs had left for me. By the time I'd putted out to Hank, he was better than halfway across. When I got close, he stopped swimming and trod water, squinting against the water to see who was picking him up, as he waited for me to stop the boat for him. But I found I was no more able to slow the motor than I'd been able to speed it up. I had to make three runs before Hank realized I couldn't stop for him. He got a hand over the side on the third time by and jerked himself on board, his long, veined arms snapping his body into the air like an arrow fired from a lemon-wood bow. As he rolled into the boat, I saw why he had limped in his swimming stroke and why he had used only the one hand to pull himself from the water. Two fingers were missing from the other, but other than that, he still seemed pretty much in prime. He lay for a moment in the bottom of the boat, blowing water, then climbed onto a seat facing me. He dropped his face into his hand as though he were rubbing the bridge of his nose or wiping the water from his mouth. This was his characteristic attempt to either hide the grin you already knew was there or to draw your attention to it. Watching him, watching the way he had jerked himself into the boat with flawless physical control, and now watching the composure with which he confronted me, at ease, as though he had not only known it was me coming to pick him up, but had planned it that way, I felt the momentary optimism I'd experienced back on the dock replaced by a surge of apprehension. If the giant is weakening, watch out, watch out. Then he had chosen a poor way to demonstrate it. Still, he didn't speak. I fumbled out some apology for being unable to stop the motor to pick him up and was about to explain that Yale offered no course on seamanship when he raised his wet eyebrows, without moving his face, without lifting it from his hand, raised his brown and beaded eyebrows and looked at me with eyes as bright and green and poisonous as copper sulfate crystals. "You had three tries, bub," he observed wryly, "and missed me every time. Now don't that frost you?" While Indian Jenny, having swallowed enough snuff and whiskey to make her feel confident of her race's ability to influence certain phenomena, looked out through the spider web that laced her lone window and finished her spell. "Oh, clouds! Oh, rain! I call down all sorts bad weather and bad luck on Hank Stamper, Then turned her black little eyes back into the empty shack to see if the shadows were impressed. And Jonathan Drager, in a motel in Eugene, wrote, "Man will do away with anything that threatens him with loneliness, even himself." And Lee, riding with his brother across the river toward the old house, wondered, "Home again, all right. But now what?" All up and down the coast, there are little towns like Wakanda, logging bars like the Snag, where weary little men talk about hard times and trouble. The old wino bolt cutter had seen them all, has heard all the talk. He's been listening over his shoulder all afternoon, hearing the younger men talk about the trouble nowadays, as though their dissatisfaction is a recent development, a sign of unusual times. He listened for a long time while they talked and pounded the table and read bits from the Eugene Register Guard, blaming the despondency on "these troubled times of brinkmanship, blamesmanship, and bombsmanship." He listened to them accuse the federal government of turning America into a nation of softies, then listened to them condemn the same body for its hard-hearted refusal to help the faltering town through the recession. He usually makes it a rule on his drinking trips into town to remain aloof from nonsense such as this. But when he hears the delegation agreeing that much of the community's woes can be laid at the feet of the stampers and their stubborn refusal to unionize, it's too much for him to take. The man with the union button is in the middle of explaining that these times demand more sacrifice on the part of the goddamned individual when the old bolt cutter rises noisily to his feet.
"These times," he advances on them, his bottle held dramatically aloft. "What do you think? Everything used to be apple pie and ice cream?"
The citizens look up in surprised indignation. It's regarded as something of a breach in local protocol to interrupt these sessions.
"That bomb talk? All horseshit."
He rears over their table, unsteady in a cloud of blue smoke.
"That depression talk? And that other business? That strike business? More horseshit. For 20 years, 30 years, 40 years, all the way back to the big war, somebody been saying, 'Oh, me, the trouble is such. Oh, my, the trouble is so. The trouble is the radio. The trouble is the Republicans. The trouble is the Democrats. The trouble is the communists.'"
He spat on the floor with a pecking motion of his head.
"All horseshit."
"Well, what, in your opinion, is the trouble?" The real estate man tilts back his chair and grins up at the intruder, preparing to humor him. But the old fellow beats him to the punch. He laughs sadly, the sudden anger turning as suddenly to pity. He shakes his head and looks about at the citizens.
You boys,"
then places his empty bottle on the table and crooks a long, knob-knuckled forefinger around the neck of a full bottle, and shuffles out of the bright sun that slants through the snag's front window.
"Don't you see? It's just the same plain old horseshit as always."
You can make a mark across the night with the tip of an embered stick, and you can actually see it fixed in its finity. You can be absolutely certain of its treacherous impermanence. And that is all. Hank knew. As well as he knew that the Wakanda has not always run this course. Yeah, you want to know something about rivers, friends and neighbors? Along its 20 miles, numerous switchbacks and oxbows, sloughs and backwaters mark its old channel. You want me to tell you a thing or two about rivers? Some of these sloughs are kept clean by small currents from nearby streams, making them a chain of clear, deep, green glass pools where great chubs lie on the bottom like sunken logs. In the winter, the pools in these sloughs are nightly stopovers for chevrons of brant geese flying south down the coast. In the spring, the pole willows along the banks arch long, graceful limbs out over the water. When an angler breeze baits the tree, the leafy tips tickle the surface and tiny fingerling salmon and steelhead dart up to strike, sometimes shooting clear into the sunshine like little silver bullets fired from the depths. Funny thing is, I didn't learn this thing about rivers from the old man or any of the uncles or even Boney Stokes, but from old Floyd Evenright. A couple years ago, that first time Floyd and us locked horns about the Union. Some sloughs are flooded spear fields of cattail and skunk cabbage where loons and widgeon breed. Some are bogs where maple leaves and eelgrass and snakeweed skeleton with decay and silently dissolve into purple oil-sheened mud, and some of the sloughs have silted in completely and dried enough to become rich blue-green deer pastures or two-story-high berry thickets. The way it happened, I'd come to town to meet with Floyd Evenright that first time this closed-shop business came up and instead of taking the cycle, I figured I'd use the boat to try out this brand-new Johnson Seahorse 25 I'd picked up in Eugene not a week before. And swinging in toward the municipal dock, I wanged into something floating out of sight, probably an old deadfall washed loose. And the boat and motor went down like a rock, and I had to swim it, mad as hell, and sure as shooting in no frigging mood to talk labor organization. There is one such berry thicket upriver from the Stamper House, a thicket so dense, so woven and tangled, that even the bears avoid it. From the mossy bones of deer and elk trapped trying to trample a path rises a wall of thorns that appears totally impenetrable. In the meeting, Floyd did most of the talking, but I didn't do my share of the listening. I couldn't get my mind on him. I just sat there looking out the window where my boat and motor had sunk, feeling my Sunday slacks shrink dry on me. But when Hank was a boy of 10, he found a way to penetrate this thorny wall. He discovered that the rabbits and raccoons had tunneled an elaborate subway system next to the ground, and by pulling on a hooded oilskin poncho to protect his hide from the thorns, he was able to half-crawl, half-worm his way through that snarl of vines. Floyd kept talking on and on. I knew he was expecting me and the half-dozen or so other Gippo men to be mowed right over by his logic. I don't know about them other boys, but for myself, I wasn't able to follow him worth sour apples. My pants dried. It got warmer. I pulled on my motorcycle shades so's he couldn't see if I'd dropped off during his talk, and I leaned back and sulked about the boat and motor. When the spring sun was bright above the thicket, enough light filtered down through the leaves so he was able to see, and he would spend hours on his hands and knees exploring the smooth passageways. He frequently came face to face with a fellow explorer, an old boar coon who, the first time he encountered the boy, had huffed and growled and hissed, then turned loose a musk that put a skunk to shame. But as they met again and again, the old masked outlaw gradually came to regard this hooded intruder as something of a partner in crime. In a dim passageway of thorn, the boy and the animal stand nose to nose and compare booty before they go on with their furtive ramblings. "What you got, old coon? A fresh wapitoo? Well, look here at my gopher skull." Floyd talked on and on and on, and what with sitting there half asleep, stewing about the boat and river and all, I got to thinking about something that had happened a long time before, something I'd clean forgot about. He found countless treasures in the passageways, a foxtail caught in the thorns, a fossilized bug that still struggled against a millennium of mud, a rusted ball-and-cap pistol that reeked still of rum and romance, but never anything near to equaling the discovery made one chilly April afternoon. I got to thinking about the bobcats I found in the berry vines is what. I got to remembering them bobcats. There were three kittens at the end of a strange new passageway, three kittens with their blue-gray eyes but a few days open, peering up at them from a mossy, hair-lined nest. Except for the nub of a tiny tail and the tassels of hair at the tip of each tiny ear, they looked much the same as barn kittens that Henry drowned by the sackful every summer. The boy stared wide-eyed at them, playing in their nest, overcome by his remarkable good fortune. "Suck egg mule," he whispered reverently, as though such a find needed the odd respect of Uncle Aaron's expressions instead of the forceful punch of old Henry's curses. "Three little baby bobcats, all by theirselves. Suck egg mule." He picked up the nearest kitten and began to fight and tear at the vine until he had made a space large enough to turn around in. He headed back the way he'd come, reasoning, without even consciously thinking about it, that the mother would most likely pick a route that he hadn't used. She'd most likely steer clear of a tunnel with man-smell in it. He found he was being slowed by holding the hissing and snapping kitten in his hands, so he took the scruff of its neck between his teeth. The kitten became immediately calm, and swung placidly from the boy's mouth as Hank sped through the blackberries as fast as elbows and knees could carry him.
Beat it out. Beat it.
When he emerged from the thicket, he was scratched and bleeding from a score of places on his hands and face, but he didn't remember any pain. He didn't remember any of the scratches. All he could recall was the soft flutter of panic beneath his chest. What would have happened had that old bitch bobcat suddenly run smack dab into a boy toting one of her offsprings in his mouth? A boy pinned down and practically helpless under 15 feet of blackberry vines. He had to sit down and breathe deeply before he could manage the 10 more yards to the empty blasting cap crate where he put the kitten. Then, for some reason, instead of securing the box and beating it back to the house as he advised himself, he hesitated to inspect his catch. Carefully, he slid back the lid and bent to look into the box.
"Hey, you. Hey there, you, Bobby the cat."
The little animal ceased its frantic scurrying from corner to corner and lifted its fuzzy face toward the sound of the voice. Then uttered a cry so tragic, so pleading, so frightened and forlorn, that the boy winced with sympathy.
"Hey, you lonely, ain't you? Huh? Ain't you?"
The kitten's yowled answer threw the boy into an intense conflict, and after 5 minutes of reminding himself that nobody, nobody but a snot-nosed moron would go back in that hole, he gave in to that yowling. The other two kittens had fallen asleep by the time he reached the nest. They lay curled about each other, purring softly. He paused for an instant to catch his breath, and in the silence that descended now that the brambles were no longer scratching and resounding on his oilskin hood, heard the first kitten crying from its box at the edge of the thicket. The thin, pitiful wail penetrated the jungle like a needle. Why, a noise like that must carry for miles. He grabbed up the next kitten, clamped his teeth over the fur at the back of the neck, thrashed quickly around in the little turning space that was already beginning to take on a smooth, used appearance, and once more sprinted on elbows and knees for that opening to safety that lay an ever farther distance away through an ever smaller tube of thorns and terror. It seemed to take hours. Time got snagged on a sticker. The vines hissed past. It must have started to rain, for the tunnel had grown quite dim and the ground slick. The boy squirmed through with eyes straining, that bobcat's child swaying and swinging in his mouth, keening a shrill plea for help, the other in the box echoing and relaying the plea. The tunnel got longer as it grew dimmer. He was certain of it, or the other way around. He gasped for breath through the fur in his teeth. He battled the mud and vine as though it were water drowning him, and when he broke into the clear at the end of the tunnel, he drew a huge breath like a swimmer coming after many minutes into the glorious air. He placed the second kitten in the box with the first. They both hushed their yowling and became quiet and drowsy against each other. They began to purr quietly along with the soft swish of rain through the pines. And the only other noise through all the forest was the broken-hearted wailing of that third kitten, alone and frightened and wet, back in that nest at the end of that tunnel.
"You'll be okay," he called assurance toward the thicket. "Sure, it's raining now. Mama'll be hustling back from hunting. Now it's raining."
And this time even went so far as to pick up the box and walk a few yards toward home. But something was strange. Safe as he knew himself to be, he had picked up the .22 from the hollow log where he always stashed it during his forays into the thicket. His heart still pounded and his stomach still heaved with fear, and the image of that mother's cat's wrath still burned in his head. He stopped walking and stood very still with his eyes closed.
"No, no, sir, by gosh, I ain't."
Shaking his head back and forth.
"No, I ain't such a dummy as that. I don't care what."
But the fear continued to shake against his ribs, and it occurred to him that it had been shaking that way constantly from the moment he'd found the three kittens playing peacefully in their nest, because it had known it, the fear, the being awful scared of something, had known the boy better than he knew himself, had known all along from that first glance that he wasn't going to be satisfied until he had all three kittens. It didn't make any difference if they were baby dragons and Mama Dragon was breathing fire on them every step of the way. So it wasn't until he emerged the third time with the third kitten between his teeth that he was able to sigh and relax and peacefully start toward the house, triumphantly shouldering the explosives box as if it were spoils of a mighty battle. And when he met the old coon waddling toward him on the muddy path, he saluted the inscrutable animal and advised him, "Maybe you better leave off the thickets today, Mr. Jig. It's fierce in yonder for an old man."